Hello, Yovan. This is Kelsey. Can you hear me?
Okay, Kelsey, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
That's all you get two people. You got to...
Dylan wasn't going to make it at all.
Kelsey, able to hear me?
Loud and clear. Can you hear me? Hi, Johan. Can you hear me?
Screen white. Where the signs at?
Johan, this is Kelsey. Can you hear me? Okay, Johan, I'm testing again. Check 1, 2. Can you hear me?
I was not hearing anything different. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything. There are a lot of audio options on this one.
All right, Johan, I turned up all the mics over here. I can hear you. I'm carrying Teams on my phone.
I can hear you.
Hey, okay.
Yes, I can hear you.
We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:10 p.m. Monday, November 15th, 2021, and we're here in the Anchorage LIO. Developing a quorum, we have in person with us Representative Rauscher, Representative Field, Representative McKay, myself, Representative Putnam. Representative Kronk is online. Mr. Hardenbrook, is Representative Hopkins online? You're on mute, Mr. Hardenbrook.
We'll have this meeting of the House Resource Committee to order.
I'm going to take that as a no. Joining us shortly over the phone should be Representative Hannon and Shragi. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Robin, and staff, Johan and Kelsey, for handling the technical aspects of this meeting. Today we'll be hearing a presentation from Michael Klein of Gaffney Klein and Association and Associates, our LBNA consultants. Our goal today is to cover Alaska's place in the global oil and gas market. We'll not be addressing any legislation today. I think as far as handling the questions, if those of you online, if you can just shoot me a text to get in the queue, and then for those in the room, just get my attention. We'll put you in the queue, and then we'll take questions preferably at the end of each slide. We don't have any other hearings scheduled at all, so make good use of being together once for this interim, at least. So, Mr. Klein, if you could please give an introduction of yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, my name is Michael Klein. I'm with Gaffney Klein and Associates. We are management and technical consultants to the oil and gas industry. And we've been working with Alaska for some years now. I'm actually based in London, so it's a little bit later here. But we have offices in the U.S. And in Singapore. So we're always very glad to be able to work with you. And I look forward to a good discussion this afternoon. I guess as we go through this, I'll just call out the slides and you'll be able to move them. Okay. Okay. Yes, this will be a fairly, relatively high level discussion of trends in oil and gas and in particular the state of Alaska's competitive position. Let's move to slide 3, the agenda. Basically, we're breaking this down into three sections, if you like. A discussion on the oil and gas industry today, where we'll talk about recent trends and events, and there have been many of them. And then we'll go and talk about Alaska in the global context. And then we'll close with a section with a few comments and observations about taxation policy and things to keep in mind as you consider those issues. So let's move to slide 5, which is kind of an introductory slide. The oil and gas industry has always been very, very volatile, as we all know. Long periods of sometimes low prices and difficult operating environments, but also big, strong cycles where demand pulls up prices and activity and so forth. And that's seemingly the way it's always been. More recently, obviously the events in the industry have been very disruptive and distressing in many ways for people involved in the business in the industry, whether it's resource owners or operators. I think the most recent events can be traced to the 2014-2016 time period, where there was a strong downward movement, oil price collapse, lots of distress in the industry, people being laid off and so forth. Then more recently, of course, we've experienced the COVID-19 pandemic, which you know, just pulled the rug out from under the demand. And as we'll talk about in a minute, there were some other events occurring with that that weren't very helpful. But we're going to spend quite a bit of time, I think, talking about the thing that's different now, and that is the emergence of alternative energy platforms. And what that's done, in essence, to the long-term perspectives about the industry, and you know, how it's affecting decision-making, you know, with all different stakeholders. So that's one part of it. The other thing we're going to have some discussion on, we'll talk about, is the position the oil and gas companies have been in, and what their perspectives are now. And in particular, you know, we'll note, and as you know, the oil and gas companies have overall performed quite poorly for a number of years. Yes, there are ups and downs, but overall, the financial performance has not been great. And people, you know, the investors are demanding better. But that's not all that's being demanded now by investors and others. There's also a demand for action on energy transition. And so the oil and gas companies have got this kind of double-edged sword that they're grasping, if you like, financial performance and energy transition, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a second. The outcome of all that, of course, has been a wave of divestments and restructurings. These have happened, and they're going to be ongoing in the industry. The industry has always talked about, of course, being very capital-focused and efficient and all those things. Sometimes that's been true, and sometimes less so. But very definitely now, capital discipline and focus on investor returns is the watchword. And all of this has meant that there's a real focus on projects, and fewer are getting to financial investment decisions, fewer are getting sanctioned. And overall, there's just kind of turbulence, if you like, as companies deal with how they're going to manage their portfolios and their money going forward. At the same time, of course, resource owners like Alaska have challenges too. There's revenue-related challenges, but they're also trying to attract capital and good operators to develop their resources. That's critical, and that's more difficult now. And I think resource owners in general are taking a hard look what they can do to better position themselves to attract the best operators and as much capital as possible to their oil and gas sectors. So overall, for governments and states, low prices and what I'll describe as decelerating demand, which means the demand is increasing, but it's not increasing at the same pace, has meant, you know, reduced revenues, reduced tax receipts, contraction of the tax base, and a pressure on attracting companies and capital to their sector. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to say about slide 5. So if we move to 6, this, we have kind of a graphic representation of these events over time, which may be helpful. Basically, we're charting from 2020, you know, the beginning, all the way through to 2021. And what you can see is there was a very nice cycle leading up to 2008, where strong Asian demand and everything was pulling up prices and you know, the prices reached quite a high level. There was a lot of activity, a lot of projects going on. We had a very sharp correction in 2008 as a result of the financial crisis, but it was quite a quick recovery because it wasn't really a demand event at the time. It was fear. The financial crisis, what does it mean? What's going to happen? But things quite quickly started to recover, and you could see the strong cycle driven by, you know, some supply uncertainty as a result of the Arab Spring, growing demand in Asia Pacific and elsewhere. And that took us right through to like the 2014, 2015, 2016 timeframe. Well, you had fairly strong OPEC production levels at that time. You had inventories that were growing quickly, some perceptions of weakening economies, and you know, overhang of potential new supply sources like Iran, and there was a, you know, a drop off, and it was quite sharp and quite severe. At the same time, and you can see this representation here, but it's something you're very familiar with. In the lower 48, you had tight oil, shale oil developments that were really beginning to be a factor. And this continued and got stronger and stronger going forward. And then, as we said, in 2020, just as things started to get a little bit more stable, we had COVID, which pulled the rug out from a lot of folks. There was a lot of demand disruption, and unfortunately, at the same time, Russia and Saudi Arabia decided to get into it, and there was this, you know, short but sharp supply war that really put the capper on it and made it very, very difficult. And so there was a very sharp fall and very, very difficult for everybody in the industry, very difficult for resource owners that were relying upon their oil and gas revenues for to meet their state budgets. So that was difficult. But since then, of course, we've seen some price recovery. A lot of that, I think, has to do with, you know, everything slowing down during COVID, and suddenly things are beginning to pick up, so you get these imbalances. That's driving part of it. But there's been, you know, a fairly decent price recovery. What happens going forward from here, of course, is to some extent, everybody wants to know. But that's the historical picture, and maybe this is a good time to stop if there's any questions about that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Questions from the committee representative Boucher.
Thank you. To the chair, Mr. Klein, I'm looking at the graph. And if you started December 2007 and you were to project a line from the high points, it's pretty much a downward, trend that I can see. Even though it comes back up, it's still a downward trend when you're trying to hit all the highs and you're following it. Yeah. So are we in that downward trend now, do you think? Or are we going to come out and now you can start to project the line in an upward direction for the future? Or is this projection of the high point or getting to the high point of the next downward cycle that we could expect to see on the horizon? Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, it's the $1 million question that everybody's trying to answer. Right now, I mean, as I said, I think part of this is to do these imbalances coming out of a period where COVID suppressed so much activity. So I expect, you know, for some period of time, things will be tight, both for liquids and gas. And so that's going to raise prices. You might have some quite difficult times in some countries, Europe maybe, and others where they don't have the energy supplies. And so that's going to, you know, things are tightening up now. But what I expect is that, you know, that supplies will increase, both of liquids and gas. And so that pricing is going to moderate. All the while, of course, you have shale oil and things like that, which are big engines and can be relatively more quickly turned up, if you like, to meet supply. So I think you might see demand. Well, I think you will see energy demand increasing. The real question here is how much of that demand is going to be met by fossil fuels, and in particular oil and gas, and at what rate these new energy platforms, if you like, are going to grow, because they're growing already. And so it's a question of trying to get a sense of what the rate of, you know, it's, for instance, power generation. If you get new power generation, how much of that is going to be gas? How much of that's going to be nuclear? How much is going to be renewables, wind and solar? These are the big questions that are out there. And I think if you look, you'll see, you know, studies. There are studies from the IEA and others which look at different scenarios. And you know, some scenarios are very high supplies of oil and gas and relatively high costs for renewable, for instance. And in those kinds of scenarios, what you see is while the trend towards renewables is in the same direction, it's more moderated, if you like. It's not replacing fossil fuels as quickly. However, if you turn it around and you see a lower supply picture for oil and gas and lower costs for renewables, then it flips. And in that scenario, I think it becomes a more challenging environment for the oil and gas sector, obviously. And so we have to see what's going to happen. It's probably going to be a combination of all these sectors. But I think your question is right on point. It's just hard to know exactly where this is going to go.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brasher. Mr. Klein, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Klein, is it accurate to assume that a likely scenario is that oil will not remain far north of $60 per barrel or so, given the economy of producing oil profitably, those prices from shale producing regions, including the Permian?
Sorry about that, Representative Fieldman.
You think this long-term prices? Long-term prices at 50 is what you were suggesting?
Well, I said 60, but somewhere in there, is it reasonable to suspect that given the price point of profitable shale production, oil is unlikely to remain, say, at 80 for a long sustained period with current technology?
I think that's a reasonable perspective. I'm sure that we can find people that would disagree with it. But I find it a reasonable perspective.
Thank you.
As you say, shale oil is one of the big factors here, but it's not the only one. You have in OPEC, quite a bit of capacity, and maybe new supplies coming on. So it always comes down to the lowest cost producers and what they can put out there. So yes, I think your perspective is a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. I don't see any other questions before moving on to the next slide.
Okay. So the slide 7, titled Energy Transition and Oil and Gas. So yes, as we were discussing, the thing that's different about today that was maybe not in the frame 20 years ago is energy transition as an immediate and highly topical area. We can see that it's happening. We can see that it is on the front of a lot of people's minds and discussions. So a number of things. One, I think the first thing is to be realistic about the energy transition. a lot of the technologies that are part of these different platforms are still in development. They may face significant hurdles in terms of addressing issues of intermittency, which is, you know, so much sun in the, you know, during the day, or so much wind and so forth. You know, energy storage is a big issue. It's important. Everybody knows it's very important to make these technologies really to help them kind of grow their footprints. But you know, there's still a lot to be done on developing energy storage that is efficient and cost effective. And then, of course, when you think about energy, it permeates every aspect of our lives, and you have it's an immensely complex and system, and changing it is a massive undertaking, and it's very, very costly. So there's a lot of things out there that are, you know, so it's not, you know, there's a lot of things that need to happen for this transition to occur. It doesn't mean they won't, and almost certainly it looks like they will. But the question is how quickly. Well, again, this is another one of those areas where you have people with you know, smart people with widely different assumptions and thus different views of how long the transition will occur. And of course, transition isn't a single thing. It's lots of different, has lots of different strands, different technologies, different aspects to it. But broadly speaking, you know, a lot of the conversation is about transition occurring in a significant way over the next 20 to 40 years, say. But what are the trends that are clear? Well, there's a, you know, enormous focus on it, and so there's a lot of innovation, a lot of money going into it, and there's new applications being developed at all time. At the same time, and this is crucial, there's rapid cost reductions in many of the key technologies like solar and wind. You know, in solar, the panels, they're getting more efficient, cheaper to produce. Wind, they're putting out these huge turbines and they're able to produce an enormous amount of energy quite efficiently. So there's this rapid technological innovation. Costs are coming down. There's new applications all the time. So that is a key feature of what we're seeing in energy transition. So renewables and other, you know, clean power sources are growing quite rapidly. We see electric vehicles have kind of made that step where they're no longer kind of a curiosity. That, you know, there's a lot of them out there. They're on a rapid growth trend, and so there's a lot of these pieces that are coming together quite quickly now. It's still a lot of uncertainty about which ones are going to be most successful, which you know, drivetrains, which sources of energy, and those kinds of things. But it's happening. The other thing that's happening, of course, is that it's not just some scientists or people with a particular kind of perspective on the environment or whatever that have bought into it. Just about everybody's bought into it now, to some extent or another. And it's core strategy, whether you're BlackRock, you know, you're on Wall Street, and even companies that have been reluctant for reasons that are, you know, understandable, like Exxon and BP and so forth. They're having to grasp the metal and decide what role they're going to play in it. And if you take them at their word, and I think probably it makes sense to do that, they see this as the trend that they've got to deal with now, and it's going to happen. So So these are very important. So it's no longer a matter of if, but, you know, it's just when, how quickly is this going to happen, and what are the implications for all the different stakeholders and resource owners and companies and service companies and all of the people that have an involvement in the oil and gas sector, particularly. What is the knock-on effect for them? And how can they kind of position themselves to one, be successful at what they're doing, which is being successful oil and gas producers or successful governments that are promoting investment and capturing as much revenue as they can from those resources. How do they put the position themselves to do that? That's kind of key. And everybody in the sector has its little piece of it to worry about. Okay, so that's another slide. I don't know whether we have questions on that, or would you like me to move a little bit further on?
I'm not seeing any, Mr. Klein. Go ahead.
Okay, so let's move to slide 8. Top title, energy transition is an issue for capital markets. Really, this slide is just trying to make a very simple point. It is that financial institutions all over the world, from sovereign wealth funds to Wall Street, you name it, many of them are looking at decarbonization and considering their investments in light of those kind of, you know, climate change, decarbonization, energy transition. And part of that is, you know, pure focus on where the opportunity lies. But part of it, I think, you know, obviously as well, is for the social responsibility or driver. It's a lot of the capital that the oil and gas industry has traditionally been able to rely upon and access, right, in a relatively straightforward way. It's tightening up and it's becoming more and more difficult. And you can see that it impacts, you know, particularly smaller companies that have relied, or smaller mid-sized companies that have relied upon, access to, you know, buoyant capital markets, that they're having to really think hard about how to put together programs that can be funded. And in some cases, this has led to companies feeling that they have to merge with other companies or get taken out. I was actually just reading something the other day about the oil search Santos merger. And one of the comments was, you know, that they have a lot of projects, including Pika in Alaska, that are big financial requirements, and that maybe part of the driver of, not maybe, part of, one of the drivers for the transaction was to be part of a larger organization that had more capacity to fund those kinds of developments. And I think it's an important point. When you look maybe at some of the more challenging developments that are potential developments rather in Alaska, some of those are probably quite difficult for smaller companies to do, the exploration and to do the whole course of appraisal and development in a, you know, high cost and difficult environment. Maybe those kinds of developments take bigger companies with bigger balance sheets. And so this is another impact that we're seeing that I think is relevant to Alaska and other resource owners. I won't dwell on that anymore unless there's some questions on the capital markets type issues.
We've got Representative Rauscher, then Representative Field.
Thank you. I see the chair. Mr. Klein. So the recent actions from the U.S. President Biden has been worrisome in our respect, but has that made a big impact on investment from where we were, say, a year ago to where we are today? Has that chased away more on a large percentage of investors, or are we about the same place we were a year ago? I guess I'm just trying to understand the impact of this decision.
It's an interesting one. I think that, you know, obviously, President Biden has an approach which, while I think he's fine with projects like Willow and you know, kind of worked out projects going forward, has raised, you know, maybe a regulatory burden or hurdles, searching for the right word, but for other projects. And I think that is something companies have to think about. Is it new? I'm not sure it's new. I think maybe it's more indicative, just the fact that we change presidents every 4-8 years, and of course in other countries, you know, there are changes as well. And I think the question perhaps that people are asking, because, you know, oil and gas developments are quite long term. So especially when they're big and they're difficult operating environments. And so the question becomes, what do I think is going to be the case next year? Okay, that's fine, but what is it going to be like in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years? Because that's the kind of horizons we're looking at. So I think, you know, the actions or the policies you see today are relevant, but only insofar as they're indicative of what, or give an indication of what's going to happen over the longer term, or give a sense of the trend, if you like. And I think that perhaps what people may be looking at is it's going to change. You know, if you have one kind of president in, you may have a more deregulated approach, another one a more regulated approach. But in general, which way is it going? And I think in general, people will probably think that there's going to be more scrutiny of oil and gas projects, especially in areas that for one reason or another are deemed to be sensitive. And I think that's probably where people are at right now. Are they worrying hugely about any one president? Or, you know, maybe not, but they may be worried about the trend.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Gross. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, so lots of lenders are not lending for these projects. Who is still lending, and is it sort of less reputable banks? State-controlled banks, maybe from less democratic countries, who's still lending to these projects if all these folks are not?
I missed part of that. Could you go over the question again?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
So lots of financial institutions are not lending for these projects. I assume some still are. Who are those lenders who are still out there? Are they less reputable banks, state-controlled financial institutions? Who is still lending for some of these projects that are having a harder time raising money?
I'm not sure that it's less reputable, but what you may find is people, you know, that you do have opportunistic or lenders that see the opportunity. And I think you see some of that now, you know, especially when we started getting this tightness in the market. The lenders, they're not as concerned about the bigger picture in terms of climate change. You know, they may go in and be quite opportunistic and lend, but those, they generally are a little bit more expensive. I think the cost of funds is a little bit more expensive because they see it's more difficult and therefore They are, well, add some fees and so forth. So I'm not sure, you know, whether it's less reputable or anything. I think it lends itself to, different kinds of lenders that may be quite sharply focused on the returns and everything. And I don't know, I may not have explained that very well, but I think it's a little bit like, you know, big banks versus private equity. There's nothing wrong with private equity at all, but it's that they are likely to come in and pick up types of opportunity that then they have a little bit more risk, but then they'll charge a little bit more and so forth. So I think that's probably the biggest part of what you're going to see out there.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up, I'd just be interested in what are the institutions that are actually lending these projects to the extent that we know them. I'm just curious. Thank you.
Okay. The fields, I can be safe to assume that you can provide that list to all committee members, not just Representative Fields. And then kind of pivoting off of some of the discussion and some of the other slides, points before, when you have a more costly financing of a oil and gas development project, and I believe it was a couple slides before where you talked about governments and states looking at whatever oil and gas projects as a tax base and any adjustments there. I think some of the points that you just made as far as it becoming more costly to pursue it is a good thing to keep in mind when we start discussing tax policy. I just wanted to make that point to you, Mr. Klein.
Yeah, agreed. Shall I continue or?
Yes.
To the next one. So, this slide is oil and gas portfolio restructuring due to energy transition. One of the interesting things, that we are seeing is that obviously when times are more challenging for oil and gas companies, investors are not so happy. There's restructuring designed to get rid of less profitable assets, and so forth. But another kind of restructuring and divestment you're seeing relates to, companies seeking to kind of offload, if you like, the more carbon-intensive assets they have. And we've seen some examples of that. We've seen some in Iraq and some other places. Now, it's early days on that, I think, in some ways. But, you know, and it's easy to be a little bit skeptical about companies that sell their asset and claim that they're, you know, doing this for the good of mankind, when somebody else is just going to produce the asset. And anyway, but putting aside that kind of, you know, unnecessary cynicism, if you like, I think it is something you're going to see. Because if you think about heavy oil projects or oil sands or things like that have a really high carbon intensity, I think that the natural tendency, and often quite expensive, I think the natural tendency is going to be portfolio adjustments designed to kind of move those out and focus on more profitable, maybe less carbon intensive things, because all these companies now have to report. They have all set ambitious targets for themselves, and they want to be seen and presumably to actually succeed at decarbonizing their portfolios to meet those goals. So I think it's something that's out there, and it's an interesting development, along with, you know, the more traditional reasons for that divestment and restructuring is going to be a feature going forward.
Question.
Okay, I think we can probably move on to slide 10.
Mr. Blunt, actually, before we go there, we've got a question from Representative Fields.
Sure.
Thanks to the chair. Do these carbon intensity reductions at 2050 represent the company's self-identified goals, or are these more an independent analysis of where the companies are actually heading based on decisions they're making right now?
I think it's their announced goals. I think people are beginning to try and assess whether their actions are aligned with their goals, but I think that it's kind of early days yet. There's a whole area where assessment of carbon intensity and independent, especially independent assessments of it, is developing. But it's quite early days yet. So I think at the moment, really, it's these companies identifying for themselves and creating their own, to some extent, their own metrics. But I think over time, that there's going to be standards are developing for assessing these things, and they will be assessed and measured against, you know, kind of general standards.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. We were ready to go to the next slide, Mr. Klein.
Okay. This is slide 10, titled Decelerating Demand and the Competition for Investment Dollars. So we have a number of trends that are quite clear. Who are going to be the dominant players going forward? Well, we believe it's most surely going to be the lowest cost producers with large resources, such as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries. In an environment where there's decelerating demand, these countries, these producers have the ability to maximize production, and they've got strong reasons to do it because they have large populations, young populations, and they have big budgetary requirements. So these countries are going to be very, very dominant, and more dominant as time goes on. We think obviously shale oil, and especially in the lower 48, it's still very potent force and will continue to be that force because of its ability to kind of react quite quickly to, you know, increases in prices and demand. And if it's, you know, I think it's, you know, a consensus that ability to kind of react quickly to the demand and price spikes will act as a kind of restraint on upward price pressure. And it goes back to a question that was asked just a moment ago, or an observation that was made just a moment ago. And so the net effect of much of this, I think, is that, you know, you have decelerating demand, you have a kind of a soft price environment overall. And I think what that means for oil and gas companies is there's probably going to be less investment over the long term, through like 2050. And especially when you have very big, you know, big developments, or they're very expensive and they have long lead times, those kinds of developments need to be very, very carefully considered in this environment, and will be, you know, the ones that I think that are most likely to be affected. So for the kind of for big resource owners like Alaska, what you're seeing is a competition for oil and gas investment. It's just a competition. You're competing with all these other countries, and it's a fierce competition, because everybody understands now what they're doing. And they understand the tools that you can use to make yourself more competitive. So it's just one of those things that you should have in your mind as you go forward. Certainly oil and gas companies are going to be looking at projects and having pretty rigorous metrics to in terms of profitability and returns on investment. That is for sure. And they're also, as we touched upon just a moment ago, it's a very long-term business. So when they think about investments today or next year or the year after. They're projecting forward, and you have to look forward and say, what's it going to be like in 10, 15 years? And those are the kinds of filters, if you like, that they their investment analysis through. All of this, you know, makes for a very competitive environment for oil and gas resource owners. Okay. I'm not sure if there's any questions there, or you'd like to move to, there's a related, the next slide is kind of related, so maybe what we can do is that slide, that's slide 11, and then stop, because there might be a good point for discussion then.
Yeah.
Okay. So what can governments do, and what have governments done to address this buffeting? These difficult environments that they've been in recently. Many of the techniques, you know, one, they recognize that it is important to take action, in extreme environments to make sure that companies don't go away or don't just stop investing and stop drilling. You want to try and keep things going. And one of the tools, and easy to manipulate in a way, is tech policy. Can you reduce royalties? Can you accelerate depreciation? Can you reduce, lower taxes? Can you provide credits? All of these different techniques have been used in different ways by different countries around the world. Often on a temporary basis, because they recognize the volatility, but these kinds of tools are used to try and, some of it is to protect existing people, but also to keep their core exploration and appraisal and development kind of set of activities going forward. And so I think we saw quite a bit of that after 2014, when everything fell off a cliff a little bit, and certainly 2020 is hard to evaluate exactly what's happened in 2020. But I think that there's some countries like Norway that have taken some kind of sharp but temporary actions to try and smooth out the downturn for companies in their sectors. I think it's rather easy to use taxes as a way of addressing these issues. It's also important to know the limitations of it. And one of them is you can make changes in your tax or your fiscal system. It may take time. It may take time for that to show whether or not it's working. It's also very true that we can make changes to fiscal systems and be nevertheless overwhelmed by that. And I'm sure we've all seen examples of that as well. So it's a useful technique, a useful tool, but there are limitations on what you can do with it. So I think maybe stop there. We've had a couple of slides around those issues. See if there's any questions.
Representative Welch.
Yeah, thank you, through the Chair, Mr. Klein. In terms of profitability and return on investment, and I guess what you have stated is like a fierce competition, where do you see, I guess, what I'd call as the hot ticket for Alaska, where we can say that there would be that this is a project or these are projects worth investing and count on for the state of Alaska in terms of oil and gas? And is there one, or is it, or what is this? What is the future prediction there for you in our state?
Yeah, I think we're actually going to get into this a little bit and when we get into the section on Alaska, but let me just kind of, I guess, preview it a little bit. Alaska's got you know, wonderful resources. And it's got, you know, although many of some of the big assets are maturing now and everything, they've got still got some big projects out there. And they've got, you know, potentially big projects in different areas, if they can ever get those going. And I think the kind of, in a nutshell, we actually think that Alaska is a bit of a, it has aspects of mature basin, but it also has pretty significant aspects of areas that are, you know, not really that explored, and there are, you know, where there's really big potential. And so the way you think about it is, what you need in Alaska is you need to be able to attract all these different kinds of companies, big companies, small companies, companies that are focused on, you know, small, maybe smaller, nimble companies that are focused on optimizing mature assets that maybe the big companies don't want to or are not as good at dealing with. But you also need the companies that can develop projects like Willow and that can go and do these very expensive, challenging exploration things, which are mostly tend to be bigger companies. So I think that's the picture we see for Alaska. You actually need to have a real diversity of companies in there. And what that means, I guess, is you need to, you know, tailor your approach to encourage all of these different companies to want to participate in all your license rounds and all your projects.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Representative McKay.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Klein. Is there a country or a state in the world that has accomplished what you just described that we could look to as an example of a model that we should follow to do the attraction of small and large companies and diversify our industry?
It's no good. Really good question. I think, you know, countries like Norway have been very successful, but they do it the Norwegian way, and I'm not sure that would work everywhere. But they've been well, you know, they've done a pretty good job of getting all different kinds of assets going forward. The UK is a good example now, maybe of what you can do in a maturing basin when things are really getting difficult, and you know, there's been kind of a rotation of the bigger companies going out and the smaller companies going in. I think the answer maybe for Alaska is some combination of these things. Maybe there's not one that's perfect, but maybe you could put together an overall strategy that incorporates some of the learnings from different places and achieve what you want to achieve. So I may have been a little bit elusive on that answer, but I think it's out there. I think the answer is out there, but I'm not sure it's out there in one place.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Seeing no other questions, Mr. Klein, please proceed.
Okay. So let's move to the more Alaska-focused discussion, to slide 13. This one's titled Alaska's Oil and Gas Sector is Maturing and Facing Headwinds. So for many years, it's been a really terrific place for oil and gas companies and service companies and so forth. It's got, you know, very attractive resources, good access to a market, of a skilled workforce, strong service company base, all of the things that make for a successful sector. Of course, over time, some of those assets have matured, and that is exactly what's happened. And you have assets like Prudhoe Bay that, you know, they're mature, they're producing a lot less oil, and that's, you know, overall impacting everything. It's also true that in Alaska, it's bringing new assets on stream to replace declining production from these really big fields is not always straightforward for different reasons. And, you know, I'm citing Willow as an example, but I'm sure there are others where you could say that whether because of regulatory hurdles or operational challenges or for different reasons, it's not that easy for the companies to get from exploration to development on bigger assets. So, you know, it's Alaska has a challenging and a relatively high cost operating environment, you know, with the relatively short window of time each year for activities. And on top of that, of course, they're part of a global oil and gas industry. And the headwinds that are faced by some of these other, you also face some of those in Alaska in terms of volatility and demand, you know, accelerating demand and those kinds of things. So there is a number of challenges that you're facing going forward. We know that you've always been given a lot of thought to different ways to improve to make it a more hospitable environment for companies and thus to promote activities. And I'm referencing the MAPA for barrel tax credit here, but there's undoubtedly other examples. But as I said before, you know, there's some limits on what these kinds of techniques can do. They can be overwhelmed by events. So let's move on to give a little bit more background here. And this is really just the next slide is called Maturing Assets Leading to Production Declines. And this is really, I guess, driving the point home with a little bit of a graphic. But you can see here that you have close to 450,000 barrels a day of production as of 2020. But this is a relatively small fraction of where you were back in the 80s. And so this is, you know, a big impact. And assets like Prudhoe Bay have shown that in a very dramatic way. You can see Prudhoe Bay is the light blue or the baby blue in the graphic. You have other assets, of course, that are maturing too, I mean, the Cook Inlet and others. And you have some new fields as well that are in there. So I think the takeaway is, yes, this change in your industry, I mean, the change in your resources and maturing of your assets has had a pretty dramatic effect on production and thus revenues. And of course, that all has a knock-on effect to jobs and everything like that. But still, you have the resources, and it's a substantial contributor. So there's a lot here to be worked on going forward. So I don't know if there's any questions at this point, or we should move on to the next slide.
Representative McKay.
Thank you through the chair. Mr. Klein, the very last bullet, the 11,700 jobs were lost. I presume that's United States, or is that Alaska? I guess I want to make sure I understand that number.
I think it's Alaska. We got that from the McDowell Group report, a 2018 report, but it's Alaska.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Okay, yeah.
Representative Roche?
Through the chair. What was the time frame on those 11,000 jobs that were lost? I missed it.
It's from a 2018 McDowell Group report. The timing of the loss of the job specifically, I'd have to go back and look at that. But it was reported during, I think it's the 2014 to 2016 period, but I'd have to double check on that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I think that's it, Mr. Klein. I don't see anything online. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so we'll move to slide 15, which is titled Sustaining Petroleum Revenues for Alaska. Okay, so obviously this is a key point. So if you have assets maturing and productivity dropping off, you have to do something to replace those. But it's not just new assets. One, you of course want to nurture and optimize those maturing assets for as long as you can. But also you need to bring new projects on. And because the gap is way, the gap just gets bigger unless you do. So you need to bring in substantial new projects to fill that gap. And it's these new projects are also critically important for the economy and for jobs and for all the different kind of strands of the economy that rely upon gas revenues. It's also important, of course, that Alaska will be focuses not just on oil and gas, but energy transition. But oil revenues will be oil and gas revenues will be a bridge, if you like, that helps subsidize, as we talked about, the very the long term, very expensive transition to alternative energy platforms. So it's two factors that are really, really important. We highlighted below, but it's really just an example of what a big new project can do for an economy. And, it's a very large, expensive development, but it's creating a lot of construction jobs, a lot of permanent jobs, and it's going to contribute, significant production year on year, at its height, 160,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day. And then it's also filling your taps, your pipeline up, which is key, as well. So these projects are very important, to sustain the revenue base. But it's not just Willow. I don't mean to make it sound like it is. Projects like PICA are also important. All projects of that kind of size that require significant investment and long-term commitment, they're very important projects to sustain, as well as making sure that your maturing assets are properly stewarded and optimized. I can stop there if there's any questions on that.
I don't see any. Go ahead, Mr. Klein.
So the next slide, slide 16, is protecting the petroleum tax base and the economy. I think it's really just making the same point again that, petroleum revenues are very, very important to Alaska and will be under pressure as the industry changes. And so we need to focus on, it will be important to focus on getting as many companies, oil and gas companies, wanting to participate in Alaska. As we said earlier, in response to the question, it's not one kind of company. Very large companies are very important to drive these bigger, high capital, long lead time projects forward. You also need companies that are very focused on on optimizing mature assets and the infrastructure. We've seen that, for instance, in the North Sea, the UK North Sea, that as the bigger oil and gas companies have kind of rotated out, you've had companies come in, and they've just been able to make it work. And they've been able to extend the life of these fields for a long time. And I think Alaska companies like Hilcorp and others would do that if they're given, you know, the right environment to do it in. Again, it's the point we've made before as well, but this is what you're doing to attract oil and gas investment anticipation. It's a competitive activity. And everybody's competing for the same human capital and financial capital and technical capacity to do these projects. So you're out there competing with everybody. Okay.
Representative Rosier, question on that slide.
Thank you very much, sir, Mr. Klein, and through the chair. So I don't really know how to phrase this question, but there are power brokers. For real estate deals, there are power brokers for, whether they're mergers for Costco or wherever, where they buy out stores or they combine. Are there power brokers that can, what we're talking about here is you might need a collection of investors is what you're saying. And then, somebody's going to put those deals together. Is there power brokers out there that can do this or that do this? Or are these oil companies basically on their own to find their own way in the dark here?
Now, I think that the power broker is in essence the state by understanding its assets and by maybe engaging people to help. But developing competitive processes that pull together the right assets that are attractive with the right terms, you know, length of lease and length, you know, different financial terms, and pulling all those things together and then offering them in a competitive, generally speaking, more transparent and open. You make it, and if you have attractive assets, you will get good competition. So when you ask me who the power broker is, I think it's you. But it's important to focus on making sure that all the component parts of an attractive offering are made available. In other words, the terms, most importantly, of course, the assets. That you don't get the right assets together, then it doesn't go anywhere. But if you get the right assets, the right terms, and the right offering process, you can have a pretty compelling offering. And so I think that's what I would say to you. I mean, I guess you could always try and get an investment bank to help you or something like that. But in my opinion, that is probably not necessary. The state, and I believe Alaska does offerings. Now I don't have a particular view as to whether they're as good as they could be or whatever, but I think probably the knowledge is largely there. So it's just a question of putting it all together.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Rosher. See none other. Please continue, Mr. Klein.
Okay. So we're getting down to the last two slides, and if I go to slide 18, tax policy considerations. So When you think about your tax policy and the kinds of terms that, the key, of course, is this balancing act between wanting to capture the maximum revenue for Alaska, which is the goal, of course, it's the goal for every country in the world is to, when you go out to offer terms to oil and gas companies, is to capture the maximum economic rent, if you like, that's available for each asset. But of course, in practice, it's never that easy. It's not something you can kind of reach with some kind of mathematical precision. It involves a lot of issues and judgment, if you like, as to what is it going to take, what do I have to offer to get them to participate, and so I think one, you have to recognize the challenges associated with coming up with the right tax policies and the limitations. But also focus not just on the near term, but also the longer term perspective. So what is it that will attract people in the longer term? And I think an observation would be that companies like to see a certain amount of stability and when they look at the tax, they don't want to always think that there's a kind of something that could happen in the short term that would kind of undermine their position. And I know this in the North Sea that for many years, you know, the government was always very quick to, if there was an uptick, they would go in and tax it. That's absolutely good. But sometimes it's, you know, this too fast. And there wasn't a sense of stability there. But so I think stability is important, and also getting the structure right so that you encourage, you know, companies to do these mature, you know, to steward and look after these relatively high cost maturing assets. But also you want to make sure that the big investments, step change developments, are also encouraged in your policy. So those things we think are important. And also to have a system that encourages new interest. You know, the usual suspects, if you like. So all of these things are things you should, you know, think about when you're working on the tax policy. Clearly, if companies think that there's a lot of risk or taxes were too high, they won't enter. Or if they're there, they might try and exit, or they might just try and take their assets and harvest them, if you like, cash them out. And not invest as much as you would like to prolong the life of those assets. And then they'll go somewhere else. And that'll have a long-term impact. So it's a very challenging job to come up with tax policy, and there's lots of influences and so forth. But we think it's incredibly important to try and get this a balanced approach that encourages all the different kinds of developments that you have in Alaska. And finally, for slide 19, sorry, you have any questions?
No, continue.
Okay, and finally for slide 19, which is titled Existing Tax Credit and Competitive Position. We have not done a detailed analysis yet. This is something I think we're going to be asked to do shortly. But we've been asked the question, so what do you think Alaska is competitive with its current tax structure in international market? And we've looked at it, and it's clearly, you know, these are complex types of questions. But I guess our sense of it is at the moment that actually it's probably is relatively competitive. We would like to test that out by doing some more detailed analysis. But we know that, you know, since tobacco was introduced, the production levels seem to have somewhat stabilized. They were declining and they've somewhat stabilized. You see companies wanting to take larger assets in Alaska. You also see companies willing to invest in big projects like Willow and Pico. And so all of those are, we think, are good indications that maybe that you're not far off from where you need to be in terms of tax policy. It needs to be studied, but we think it's generally, we generally have a kind of a positive view. I think the final point, of course, is that it's never static. It's not a static thing. And you need to continually evaluate where you are in the competitive landscape and make the changes when necessary to keep your competitive position going forward. So that is really the kind of final thought there. And I hope to open it for any questions that you might have.
We need to continually be power broken.
I think you got that.
Yeah.
Representative Rauscher, then Representative McKay.
You know, thank you, Chair. You know, when I told my wife I was at a meeting here in the OIO, told her it was about gas and oil, and she said, "Oh, you're going to prayer meeting." Anyway, so my question is, it's typical. And over the decades, because I used to have a job or two in the oil industry, why is it that oil companies, when the oil is down to $5 a barrel or $9 a barrel, they're not wanting to invest at all? But yet that's when transportation is so much cheaper. That's when shipping is so much cheaper. That's when cost of creating goods is so much cheaper. They wait until the price climbs all the way back up before they get really excited about investing. And then usually it turns into a reversal shortly after that. And I'm just wondering, why does it work that way? Why I don't understand the logic. It seems like if I had a gas field and an oil field or whatever, and I was wanting to bring it on the market, I would be like, whoa, this is my golden opportunity to get it going now. And it never seems to go that way. And is it that I don't understand the process enough to be able to see the actual workings of it all, or what's the deal there? Can you enlighten me?
that's a good question, and I think that oil and gas companies are, you know, doing two things. They've got these projects, many of which are quite long-term, especially new projects that require a lot of upfront investment where they go, where they're investing more than they're taking and, you know, getting back initially. You know, so the old hockey stick kind of shape to it. And of course, you don't enter into an investment like that when you don't have a sense of that you're going to be able to make all those investments and start making money. So with a volatile environment, they're very, very cautious, especially now. I think it's very, very much the case now. They're very cautious about these new projects, big, long lead items, big ticket items. The other thing, of course, is that, you know, it's a long-term business, but these companies are judged quarter to quarter. Their investors, the analysts, and all those people, they care. They care about what, you know, this quarter, the first quarter, and the second quarter, and third quarter. You know, that's what they care about. And I think that has something to do with the unwillingness to kind of quickly move or to sustain things even in downtimes. They tend to want to retract. They want to reduce their expenditures, reduce their costs. And then there's also this lag time thing that you probably know this, that that when things go badly, they pull back quite quickly. But when things start going well again, they're quite cautious about getting back in, increasing the investment levels. And I think it's a human nature thing that when things have gone badly, you pull back on the reins harder. When things appear to be getting better, you wait and you wait and you wait, and then you buy into it, and maybe go too far. I think a lot of this has to do with the short-termism and the human nature kind of issues that raises.
Well, thank you very much.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you, Mr. Klein. I've found your presentation to be fascinating, and I really appreciate your work on this. I had a couple questions and comments, I guess, to finish up. First of all, MAPA, you call it MAPA, SB 21, I think it was passed in 2013 or 14. I'm not sure. Does anybody remember the, let's say it was 2014, so that means we've had about 6 to 8 years of experience now under SB 21 to look at. And we can assess whether that's been effective, if it's been positive or negative. The other thing I noticed, some of the things that have happened over the past couple of years, maybe 3-4 years, is a great amount of political instability. Not so much tax instability, but political instability with, we went from the Trump administration to, as far as I could tell, was very, very pro-oil, very pro-fossil fuel, very pro-Alaska, to the Biden administration, which is a complete opposite. And their posture towards Alaska has been actually antagonistic towards any development by closing down the Anwar leasing program. We have a federal judge who shut down Willow. Those are political impacts. And then, of course, the pandemic, which was completely out of the blue, completely surprised everyone. I guess you'd call that almost an act of God, kind of force majeure type event. So we've really been hit by some political and acts of God that have really hurt our industry up here. A couple of comments. What concerns me, Mr. Klein, and the committee is, and the general public, is I don't believe that the American public is going to tolerate $4, $5, and $6 a gallon gasoline for very long. And of course, that the value of that product spiking like that is going to drive up the cost of almost everything, food, everything that a person can buy. And I also were concerned with national security. I do not think that it's healthy for the United States, the leader of the free world, the country that everyone looks to defend freedom and liberty across the globe. Not good for our country to have a weak and dismembered oil and gas industry. So I don't think that these conditions can continue. I think there's going to be a correction. But I know we're kind of running long. I could ask a lot of questions, Mr. Klein, but if maybe you could comment on those statements. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Jim, thank you. So as to MAPA, as I said, we've not done a detailed analysis on it, but our general impression, mainly just from the observation of production levels seeming to stabilize a little bit, is generally that it seems to have been reasonable. It seems to maybe be working in the way it was intended to work. But I won't say that there's a detailed and analytical basis for that statement, but it's just an observation. I think you're pointing to the fact there's a lot of different factors that have occurred together to lead us to where we are today. You know, there's political factors, there's legal, you know, judicial, if you like, factors. There's, you know, there's the same kind of very, polarization in you know, on approach towards resources, oil and gas resources. And, you know, it cannot be argued that that's the case, that there is this. And then when you have the pandemic and, as you say, you know, pulling out the rug from everybody and kind of destroying so much demand, all of these things have been very, very disruptive. And I think they continue to be disruptive today because we're coming out of the pandemic, I hope. But it, you know, coming out of this is not that easy either, because we see that there's, you know, gas markets in many places are quite tight. Crude oil is getting quite expensive, and as you pointed out, it's you know, most importantly, it's having an impact on the pump. And once that happens, of course, it opens up, you know, big issues for everybody. So I suspect that there is going to be all this pain. But if you ask me whether I think prices, you know, will continue to rise, and that whether we expect really, really much, I think these things will. I think there's enough capacity in oil, crude, you know, liquids production and gas production to at some point to take the edge off of that. I don't know exactly how long it will take, but certainly we're in for a winter of discontent, I think, in some places. And that's going to be difficult. I think that, you know, how quickly that comes out is probably going to have a big impact on people's perceptions and how they feel about things. But I'm really getting way beyond my area of, I guess, expertise. But I think, you know, the points you're raising are fascinating, and they're very, very topical. And, you know, everybody's going to be addressing them for the next few years.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Thank you, Mr. Klein. I don't have any other folks online looking to ask questions. Thank you for taking part of your evening or middle of the night or whatever it is over there to oblige us with this presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been an honor. Thank you very much for inviting me to give the presentation.
All righty. With that, committee members, enjoy your summer since our last session is over now. We don't have anything else on the docket until regular session comes back up. But if we do have any ideas, we'll be in touch with you. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 2:40 p.m.